Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. And Michter's is the first American whiskey to be selected as Whiskey of the Year by Whiskey Exchange. Michter's, it's all about the whiskey.
You're listening to In the Drink with me, Joe Campanelli. When I'm not hosting In the Drink, you can find me at Fausto or Lalu, our restaurants here in Brooklyn, New York. I also make wine in Italy under the name Annona. And I'm currently working on an Italian wine book to be published by Clarkson Potter and to be released in the fall of 2020. Stay tuned for more news about that. The interview you're about to hear is with Ryan Looper, a sales representative with T. Edward Wines, and someone who I share a great love of Piemontese wines with. Ryan and I actually just both got back from recent trips to Piedmont, and we talk about our observations about what's going on, how the region is changing, and who's doing really exciting and dynamic things there. This will be the third time I've interviewed Ryan, and the previous two interviews cover Ryan's early career and his current work as a sales representative for one of New York City's leading distributors. You can find those in the Heritage Radio Network archives.
Let's get into it.
Let's go.
Let's go. Here with repeat guest, the trifecta, Ryan Looper. Welcome, welcome back. Your first time on In the Drink with Joe Campanelli, taped at Fausto.
Stoked to be here. Can I blow your mind?
Blow my mind.
We met 12 years ago.
We met 12 years
12 years ago.
Were you with T. Edward then?
I was with T. Edward.
You were?
Yeah. We met 12 years ago. That's how long we've known each other.
What?
Pretty insane.
When was the meeting? Now? Where was the meeting?
Del Anima, I want to say.
It was at Del Anima.
So Del Anima opened in
07, 12 years ago.
Yeah. I met Lauren Feldman there. Right. I met, I want to say Megan Mina at one point. Yeah, that's how long we've known each other.
Wow.
Pretty amazing.
Did you like search back on emails and find that? Sometimes I'll do that. I want to find our first email together.
They're all deleted. I've got nothing.
You got nothing?
It probably was, I'm okay with it. It's probably a horrible email on my part.
I was like, I'd like to try that La Rivolta Falanghina.
Yeah, man. It's, wow.
Because you've had them since the beginning.
Yeah.
And then you had La Torre. We're here in the cellar at Fausto looking at some boxes of not the La Torre, Il Colle, Rosso di Montalcino that we have. But I remember there were some good days of Il Colle. We used to get
85.
Like 85 Il Colle Brunello di Montalcino.
$40.
For $40. Yeah.
Not crazy. How much has changed? It's a totally different market now. It's amazing.
It's wildly different.
Yeah.
You know, I'm writing an Italian wine book with Megan Krigbaum and reading some of the things that were written contemporaneously, you know, 12, 15, 20 years ago about Italian
wine. It was a
Italian
David Lynch book, right?
It was a David Lynch book that I'm reading, rereading from cover to cover. And just like the things that were important to people about Italian wine are so different today from what they were then.
Completely. There's so much more good wine in general. I think that's one of the biggest changes. You just look at every category, every country, new things. There were no wines from the Czech Republic. There were no great wines that I knew of from Puglia. Lots of things have changed.
And what do you think is amazing. Great from Puglia?
There's a whole area around Lucera that has limestone. And there's a lot of promise in Puglia. It's not
Gioia del Colle over there, like sort of Western, but up to against Basilicata.
It's not all bulky stuff.
You've had these Fatalone wines?
No.
They're pretty cool. I know Alice Firing just did a retrospective, like 50-year vintage of Fatalone Primitivo. And I missed it, but I read some of her notes and it sounds like it's pretty cool, age-worthy stuff. And we have the Rosato at Lalu.
Think about Piemonte. Think about what was real back then. Alto Piemonte was not a big thing.
Alto Piemonte was not a big thing.
Barolo.
Other than Ferrando, right?
Yeah. Technically you could call it, I guess, it's reaching, but that's Alto Piemonte, I guess. I think Barolo's changed a lot.
How do you think? So you were just in Barolo, and we were actually we were there days apart. And I wish that we had coordinated. It would be so fun to hang out with you in Barolo. And it looked like we went to a lot of the same producers. But how do you think Barolo has changed?
For one, many less trees. I'm a little Debbie Downer, but many less trees. That's one. Two, it's everyone's rich now. The at least land rich. The sale of Arione, and you hear the prices people are buying vineyards for now. It's pretty insane.
Yeah, you can't be a young upstart producer and really want to start a Barolo. It's impossible.
Really hard. And because it's more of a business, the netting, see the netting around in vineyards to prevent the hail issue.
Yeah,
as best you can. That's big.
So I visited Aldo Vacca at Produttori, and he had such an interesting insight on the netting about how 15 years ago, people didn't want to put up the hail nets because they were afraid that it would affect photosynthesis and you couldn't get grapes ripe enough. But now, just in like this last 15, 20 years, they're actually happy to have the nets up because not only are you protecting against hail, which is happening more frequently, but you're also getting less ripe grapes, which is now a good thing.
There was also a war, a bit of a war, between this whole modern and traditional idea. Now you go to Barolo, many fewer people would call themselves a modernist.
Right.
Most people, traditional is a very classical word now that everyone says. Everyone's traditional in some sense. So that war, all those arguments, remember those where, oh, that's new oak. Oh, those are clunky rustic wines. That is pretty much cycled through, I think.
Would you say that the traditional producers are kind of making like cleaner, more elegant, delicate wines, and the more modern producers are scaling back from like new oak and ripeness?
100%.
Yeah.
Most of the wines are more drinkable younger now than they were before. I feel the gruff has been kind of taken out. Part of that's farming. Part of that's climate. Part of that's technique. People are sharing information. Yeah. There wasn't as much information sharing or international. People are drinking much more international wine, so they're very aware. They have friends in other places. They're chatting. So the winemaking, just the sharing of information has changed.
You went to Bartolo Mascarello.
Mm-hmm.
Did you taste the 2015 Bartolo Barolo?
Yes.
It's drinkable. It's like I have some 06 in my cellar that's still like way too young. Some 96 that I tasted not too long ago that felt like it just needed a lot of time in the decanter. I've never seen Bartolo Mascarello that you can open and drink so young.
It's true.
Did you feel the same way?
Like, I felt exactly the same way.
How is this so drinkable?
And he, Alan and Maria Teresa were there, and they were not going to say it was a really super warm vintage. It was a warm summer, but they were quick to say that it was pretty normal for the rest of the year. That was not something they wanted to get into too heavily. And I think that impacted a lot of the 15s on the you know, good and bad side of it. But I found them quite drinkable from the good producers.
Yeah.
And that's different than back in the day, right? 10 years ago, a young Barolo, you used to send emails saying, I don't want a Barolo that is a young vintage. And
I can't do that anymore. Joel Schott from Skernick was reminding me of that recently. I said, don't bring me anything that's at least that's less than 10 years old,
yeah.
Which you could do back then, right? I mean, not only was it important, the wines needed more time than they do now, but distributors had multiple vintages available.
Yeah, there were some that had stowed some away, and there'd been a lot of shifting at one point, so people that used to have the wines had old vintages, and the current distributor importer had younger vintages.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big question. Well, that's the other thing that's happened is there's so much old wine coming in, not through distributors these days from Piemonte. That's ramped up big time. I don't think I've ever seen so much old Nebbiolo in a market.
Yes.
Now you can really find it. It can be annoying, but yeah, you can find it.
I mean, drinking a great bottle of old Nebbiolos, I think one of the best wine drinking experiences. But I found that my taste, I wonder if this has happened with you as well. Like, I want younger wines. Like, I would, even a good Barolo, I think like 8 to 12 years is sort of like perfect for me. I'm not craving like old wine experiences the way I used to be. Have you felt the same?
Definitely, it's the spectrum has changed for me. I'm now open to drinking younger things and older things. I'm definitely really into Longa Nebbiolo. Longa Nebbiolo is the Borgogna of... So Wasserman used to say, Borgogna Rouge, you want to know a style of producer, you want to drink it young. Everyone in Burgundy drinks Borgogna Rouge young, Borgogna Blanc young. Same with Longa Nebbiolo. It hasn't quite caught fire yet. You notice that it's not really in the market the way it should be, but the upside is huge because there's more availability. The wines are a little fresher, younger, crunchier. Depending on the style, you can get a lot of wine for not a lot of money.
Who do you like from Longa Nebbiolo? We had this great night.
Who do I not like
For
Longa Nebbiolo? I think some of the top producers, the pricing can be similar to some lesser known Barolo producers. Mm-hmm. They're fantastic. I had an incredible experience at Julia Negri. I think Julia is a star and her Longa Nebbiolo is incredible. It's not released in the New York market yet. It'll be released in October, but I feel very... not only lucky to sell her wines, I think she's very blessed to be with Kermit. It's really an amazing thing. And I went and saw her the second year in a row. I've been going to Piemonte now I've done this May trip for many, many years and been lucky enough to see a lot of producers. And I have to tell you, she is quite something. And you see what she has, the terroir, and you see what she's doing in the cellar. And then you taste what she's put in bottle. It's pretty incredible.
We visited 17 producers and Julia Negri was the last one. The last one, last day, it was outstanding. And visited Giuseppe Vaira shortly before. And he was talking about actually where Julia Negri's vineyards are. It's the highest vineyard. And apparently his family was considering buying a parcel up there, I don't know, 15 years ago or something like that. And it wasn't part of the Barolo appellation at that point because the elevation was too high. And now things have changed, and that can be part of the Barolo appellation, which is wild.
Yeah, Serra d'Inari is an MGA, and it's an incredible parcel. It's a very short drive in her little buggy thing to the edge of Brico della Viola, I believe.
It's right there. I almost killed us in the buggy.
Oh, really?
Oh, someone
almost dies every time.
Oh,
maybe
really?
She should stop doing it.
We're on the buggy. We were going, you know, she has that like tour where I guess there's like a truffle hunting route, right? She takes you around that circle and it's really bouncy. And we're going down and I was like, wow, Julia's really driving fast. And I was like, she's just a crazy Italian driving really fast. I didn't realize I had my foot on the gas pedal. Oh, we were bouncing all over the place. And then she finally was like, take your foot off the gas pedal and pulled
That's
it
fantastic.
Over. And we had a moment of...
My wife actually was obviously on the trip with me and she we sat down and at one point we were going so fast. My wife was like, holy...
In the buggy.
In the buggy. And Julia laughed.
Maybe it was Julia's fault. Yeah, those wines. She is a... And it's just exciting. I mean, to see someone new and doing something totally new in Barolo. Like just because you said before that since the land is so expensive, it's rare that people are trying new things or you see new producers. And I know it was her father's winery, right? Serra
d'Inari. Yeah, Giovanni Negri, I believe is his name.
But the fact that she's not even 30 and going out and doing something all on her own, I think it's exciting.
And she's making Pinot Noir with the mentorship from the gent from Comte de Vogue. And she's making Chardonnay with Pierre-Yves Colombe.
Yeah.
She's very much, what I'm talking about, the connection with international producers and style. I think that's a producer to watch, no doubt. I think we've gotten a little monochromatic in some ways with Piemonte in the general sense with wine lists in the city. And I'd like to see a little bit outside the same big names that are allocated. I think they're incredible wines, but there is other stuff out there. And I'm hinting at Longa Nebbiolo, but there's other things, not just categories. There are producers that go relatively, they're underserved here.
I think you're right. Longa Nebbiolo and Rosso di Montalcino are two of my favorite appellations, not just because of the price, so that really certainly helps, but also the structure of both of them.
Yeah.
It's rare that I have an occasion to drink a Barolo or a Brunello, and even though they're more accessible, they do need some time. And so I think from a great producer like Julia Negri, by the way, can I put you on the spot and get a case of that?
Yeah, of course.
I don't know if it's going to be allocated or what.
It's going to be, it's coming in October, and she's actually coming in town between the 2nd and the 7th of September for, I believe, her first trip, at least the first real trip with Oliver Wine. So this is going to be quite the event because I'm impressed with her. I like what she does. I think the world of her project, and I'm going to try and do my best to put it out there for her and show her a good time in New York.
Can she stop by fast? Putting you on the spot here.
Yeah, of course.
I'd love to. Yeah, we'd love to have those wines and to do some sort of fun event here. And it sounds like you go to Piedmont more than I do, doing this annual trip. I noticed, and it was my first time there in May, so maybe it was just the first time in May, but I noticed that there was more green between the vines. There was more cover crop than last time I was there. Is that something that you've noticed at all, or is that just like happens because of the time of year I went?
It's always been like that. However, the farming in general is more organic, so for lack of a better term, than it probably was 20 years ago. Most people in the area are organic. Most. It's been a really strong shift in general. All of Canubi, I believe, is organic. There's one producer that's holding out that has a piece, but all of Canubi, let's call it 99%.
And Canubi's pretty sizable with a lot of people in there.
Oh, yeah.
Even Canubi Muscatel?
They made the move.
Wow.
It's as a group. There's one holdout. I can't remember who it is. I won't call them out on. Maybe if I do remember, I'll call them out later. But that's, I think, in general, not to make cover crop equal organic, but in general, the idea of this more positive competition, not spraying. Copper is becoming an issue worldwide. People are talking about that. There's a lot in Barolo. First of all, it's still in terms of classic areas, for me, it's the most underrated with regard to price. You can buy a great bottle of wine, put it away for not a lot of money, for what it is. Mm-hmm. These wines last forever. They're incredible, like you said. It's one of my favorite things to drink in the world.
Compared to Burgundy.
Yeah, I actually prefer it to Burgundy, but that's fine. I think Burgundy's amazing too, but I think Nebbiolo speaks to me more. I don't know why. It just does. What was it? Was there another producer that spoke to you when you were there?
Fabio Alessandria at Barolotto. He just seemed to really just be the living, true, I don't know. His experience seemed to be so like real and authentic. And
I think he's amazing. So that's another big trend that's happening now. If you can buy vineyards, one of the things he said, you buy in a cool position. You buy in a cooler site. Because he sees a lot of this warmth being an issue. So he's not buying in Sarmassa. He bought Castelletto. Castelletto he makes in 18, I believe, the first vintage. So it's a really big thing. I want to say there are some others that have bought vineyards recently. Didn't Odero buy Monvilliere? Yes. So there's stuff going on that's very important.
The traditional way of thinking would be that the best vineyard site, the place you wanted, is where the snow melted first, right?
Exactly.
But no longer. Now you can do southeast or maybe even east.
Do you think Dolcetto has a chance? That was my other one from the area that I love. Dolcetto is not an easy thing in general.
I don't love Dolcetto. It's funny. I had Alejandra from Romans on the show a couple of weeks ago, and I was saying about how I don't really love Dolcetto so much. And then she just like name dropped 5 Dolcettos and I liked them all. So maybe I like it more than I thought. Dolcetto in the Alba area or
Dolcetto
in
from the Barolo producers, they'll put out these Dolcetti and they're mostly very good.
I would drink Bartolo Mascarello Dolcetto or Giuseppe Rinaldi Dolcetto.
Have you had Principiano Dolcetto?
I have not had that.
You have to have that.
Okay.
That is one of the...
Ferdinando Principiano, right?
Yep. Very, very, very good.
Okay.
Dolcetto's another underrated one. I don't see it enough. And you could chill it down a little bit. It doesn't have to be super serious.
In Dogliani, people who make them a little bit more serious, but I think do a good job. San Ferriolo, we visited. She's
the famous one.
Incredible. And Quinto Chianetti, obviously. Cascina Corte. Have you had these?
No.
I'm pretty sure he only grows Dolcetto, ages it for 4 or 5 years before release, does organic viticulture, concrete tank, ambient yeast fermentation, unfiltered, like all these, like checks these boxes that, you know, the way you'd make like a serious low touch kind of wine, and they're just elegant and delicious. Yeah, Dolcetto. I still love Langhe Nebbiolo, and I wish we could find. I had a great experience with Capilano Langhe Nebbiolo there.
There's another producer that, just to kind of call back to the old vintage thing, I see so much old vintage Capilano around, and I don't see so much young vintage around. I think the sheer production and the way it's allocated out might be hard to get your hands on very much, and the old wine comes out consistently. Pretty interesting, right?
It's interesting. And you notice the old wine is not as expensive as you think. I mean, it's certainly a lot of money, but it has like that Bordeaux thing going on where like the old vintage might, something that's like 30 years old might be like almost the same price as the current release.
This is our big problem, quote unquote, in that if the process of distribution and trying to actually stay afloat, you have to make a little bit of money and you have to have margin on a wine when you sell it, right? So that's an issue because the old wine that has been in a cellar doesn't have that same, oftentimes they're through a third party or whatever. They don't have those same pressures. My question that I'm constantly struggling with this one is it doing justice to a producer? Like the producer still has the lights on, they're still producing. Is it helping them to have the old wine on there and not buy the young wine? Mm. Would they be happy if they walked into the restaurant and only saw old
auction? Did you got wine? Through the auction or the gray market?
I don't know
or...
if there's a good answer to that, but I think about it because we're still selling young wine, right? That's one of those things that I think this market was... There's a lot of pressure there.
In the Drink is brought to you by 750. With 750, if it's in your market, you can easily order it. Find everything you need to order in one place. All products from all distributors. Track and place orders to reps right on 750. Add the products to create your order, tag your rep, and check out to send them the order request with a specified delivery date. And the best part is, you can track your order history from all of your distributors in one place and quickly reorder. I use 750 every day.
It's funny. I had a great offer for some wine, and I'm friends with the winemaker. And there's a wine that they intentionally don't import to New York, but I really love it. I love this wine, and they don't import it.
Is this Rinaldi?
Not Rinaldi, okay. Not a Piemontese producer.
Oh, okay.
But it's, yeah, because Rinaldi, they don't import anything but the Baroli, right? So, I mean, their Fresa is outstanding. Like, I love that wine.
That's a good Langhe Nebbiolo.
That's a great Langhe Nebbiolo. The Barbera. I can't remember the flavor of the Dolcetto. Do they make a Dolcetto?
Sure. I want to say they do, but I've never had it.
But yeah, all those wines are so great and, you know, a third of the price of the Baroli. But so there's, okay, so what do you think about this? So I got this offer. I have a producer who is a friend of mine. They don't import the wine specifically because her grandfather, who's still around, doesn't want it to be in the United States. And someone got it, you know, in Europe, gray market, and it's like, can you, you know, do you want to buy this? And people would be so excited to see it on the list, I think.
Would the producer be happy?
I don't think so.
Yeah, that's my question. Maybe it doesn't matter sometimes. Maybe it should be all about your clientele. It's a really tough question because I'm always up against it here. I'm always thinking, if Teobaldo Capilano was here in this restaurant, for instance, and they saw all of this old wine that they sold to some guy that way back in the day, and then they have their chosen distributor, importer, and there's nothing from them, do they feel supported? Who knows?
Maybe Capilano is a bad example. Because I get an email from Rosenthal once a year saying, you can have 6 bottles of Barolo or 12 bottles of Barbera. That's your allocation for the year of Capilano.
So maybe not the best.
But yeah, someone else who has, you know, something like Odero would be a good example because they have lots of wines available now, but there are also older Oderos that are available.
And very inexpensive.
And very good.
Are you on the Akamaso train? Have you had some Akamaso? Did you visit Akamaso?
I didn't visit Akamaso.
That's a crazy visit.
So this is my thing with Akamaso and even Capilano. These are two just like outstanding producers. And this makes me sad to say it. And so I want you to talk me off this ledge. Because of global warming, alcohol levels have gotten so high. Capilano Pie Franco in the last vintage was 15.5%, right? Akamaso is 14.5%, 15%, maybe has gone to 15.5% as well. And this is another reason why I like Langhe Nebbiolo, but it makes me a little sad. Like, I don't necessarily want to drink a 15.5% alcohol wine. It's too ripe for me. It's too intense. And I know they have good acidities and they don't feel as hot as they look on the label, but I don't know. I feel like we missed, there's like this opportunity in the 80s and 90s for like before it got too hot, but people were still finding their way a little bit more. Do we miss the golden era?
I don't think so. I think the balance of the wines, there are some that the alcohol is just overbearing. I've had that experience with Akamaso, for instance.
Yeah.
That's a little bit of a different ball game because of the whole Damigiana thing you used to age. I mean, the way the wines act in the glass, it's a little bit of a different type of wine. Pinterno makes wines that are 15.5, nearly 16% alcohol. And Roberto's very open about the balance. You go to his place, the temperature, the Zaltos that are no longer Zaltos, the sensory glasses that are put out. The way he presents them is in a balanced way, and he wants the wines to show balance. And generally, in restaurants, when you do have the cash to buy one, they show pretty well if they've been stored properly. I don't know. I'm not as sensitive to alcohol. I've been drinking so much for so many years, Joe. I don't think 15.5 bothers me. Like I had a Chateauneuf recently that was balanced at the top, and someone turned the bottle around, and it's 15.5. I guess.
And you can have a wine that's 12.5 that's not balanced, that totally. The alcohol
it
shows.
It feels weird. 13, I had a weird wine from the Alto Piemonte that was just so out of balance. That's still the, you know,
key.
That's the key. That's the what we're all going for with all of this stuff is the balance of it.
So the balance, you have to have the alcohol. There has to be some level of like fruit concentration, right? And then acidity, and whether it's like total pH or VA can balance alcohol, right? That's something that I keep hearing more about.
I've heard a lot about, yeah, I mean, this is people are looking at the components and trying to figure out how this all works out, sort of like harmony. But my issue is we forget that we're looking at the brushstrokes and not the painting. It still is what ends up in the glass that matters. And alcohol, it's strange. If you ever had like old Zinfandel or something that had a little elevated alcohol, but not as much as it would now. Or in some cases, actually, I take that back. Some Zinfandels now, the alcohol actually lifts the wine. It makes it seem fresher than it actually is. So I'm no magician here. I have no idea why on some of these things. I just, the experience in the glass is ultimately what I'm looking forward to. You can't really argue with that. Right?
That's true.
If it's in the glass and it's corked, I mean, immediately it goes off the table and you move on.
I had a really enjoyable experience with Quinterno Barbera, 15.5. I can't remember if it was Chereta or Cascina Francia, but it was 15.5% alcohol, 2016 vintage. It was delicious.
Incredible.
Charlie Bird. Yeah, it was really good. What else? So you visited some producers that were part of your portfolio that you represent and some that weren't, right?
It's always been to get a feel for the vintage and to see, I'm lucky enough to see all basically what you would consider the top producers for many years now.
You go back to the same producers and taste
generally, yeah. There's always a few that are added in, some that are coming up. I think Luigi Odero is one that no one really talks about. That's amazing. They have the split off from the
relation
Fratelli Odero, and they have incredible parcels and an incredible winemaker, Dante Scaglione. I believe Francesco, I can't remember his last name, but he's a fantastic little Barbaresco.
Is that a T.
producer.
Edward wine?
No. Oh. No, that is with the French importer. But it's a fantastic producer of Barolo. Elio Sandri, another one in the Akamaso vein, he's got a lot of history. He's been making wine a long time. He's in Perno. He's got very organic, very old school, big old cement tanks in his cellar. That's one that people don't know. That's absolutely incredible at the top level. T. Edward, Piero Busso in Barbaresco is a superstar. Another one with a tiny estate, maybe 60,000 bottles total. Got very old Albizzani vines. He's the one I asked him about nets, and he brought me over to the vineyard row, and there was a rosary tied around the top. So that's my net. They don't want to do nets.
Wow.
Pretty amazing.
That's pretty amazing.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
He's got great sights. Definitely transitioned from having not enough wine to put in a barrel. Basically, you had to have some smaller barrels. And now all that's out. Really special stuff. Mauro Velio, Gianfranco Alessandria. We have Francesco Clerico in Monforte, which is a tiny old producer. He's about 90 years old. He's got the Colonello. It's an amazing place to go visit because if you get those 17 or 18 or 20 visits over a week, it's hard not to walk away having a feel about a vintage. So I really like where things are going. I think 16 is going to be a very interesting vintage. I think 15 is a very interesting vintage. Roberto Quinterno was very open saying, I think 15 is better than 16.
He's always a little contrarian.
He tends to be like, yes, but he was right. He said the perfect thing. He said 15 has important tannins. It has give, but it has important tannins. I think that's a really interesting thing to say. And he was tasting it in his cellar. Yeah, he's right. They do have important tannins.
I visited his winery, his new winery in Gattinara, Nervi Quinterno, which is cool to see. It's very much like under construction right now. But
yeah, in one single swoop, he's changed the Alto Piemonte too. So Arione, the buying of that changed the whole Barolo area. He's a very forward-thinking, smart guy. I'm impressed by him. The Nervi Quinterno is very much in transition for me. I don't think it's quite, I'm sure it's allocated. I have no idea how it's sold. It's allocated out and you get the rosé or whatever. But I think that it's going to go places that are amazing. Maybe not quite there yet.
Yeah.
It's an important winery. It's a historical winery, obviously.
It's a historical winery. And I didn't realize how many different owners of that winery there have been.
Yeah. There was, I think,
international owners.
A Scandinavian owner recently. There's a bank. I think the bank held the note.
Correct.
It's been really in trouble.
And so when you look, it's so funny, you go into a historic winery and they have old labels, right? They have old bottles. And usually you see just like a logical progression. And you know, it's like, oh, in the 70s, I love that label. I wish I would still have it. But you could just see how it progresses. When you go into the Nervi Quinterno cellar, there's about like 36 old labels that don't look anything like each other because every new owner kept changing the label around. It's wild.
The whole Alto Piemonte thing is wild. I think I would be buying, if I could, I'd buy much more because I love that very high acid, little bit lighter, different. There's the volcanic soil,
right?
Green sand. It's really interesting stuff. Boca, I really love. Boca, I think, is special. So I like when we represent Catalone, like the Conti, I think those are really special.
Those are cool. Did you make it up to Alto Piemonte on this trip?
We always stay in this town. I will not name it because it's too beautiful and it will be overrun by wine people. But it's on Lago Maggiore and we drive through Alto Piemonte and go down. That's sort of our move every May. I'm very thankful to go there. I think it's such a... The Alto Piemonte, you have wisteria everywhere, and the lake is there. There's this soft kind of languid pace to it. There aren't tons of people driving on the roads, rice fields. I find it meditative to go there.
It's funny. I have customers ask me all the time, when I go to Italy, do I find new producers? Do I find new wines? Do I buy wines to be on the list here? I'm like, no, that's actually not like how it works. Like, that's not possible. But that might actually be possible for you. Do you find, like, have you found producers on these trips that you've then worked with that you've then imported after?
I definitely didn't find Julia Negri, but I went there the first time and I told the Italian brand manager, this is one to watch. Mm-hmm. And luckily, via Kermit, we're going to end up selling them. It's just like one of those moments. I've been very lucky to find a few. Francesco Clerico's another one. I was introduced by Jamie at Chambers Street Wines. That was a great introduction.
Good introduction,
both
yeah.
Wines are very honest, beautiful, old school. The definition of old school. And seeing Sondri, I don't know what'll happen with that, but Sondri is underrepresented and a really incredible producer.
You guys already had just such a great portfolio, and then to add the Kermit Lynch wines to it.
It's a big deal. Punta Crena is a big deal.
Punta Crena is a big deal. Yes.
Have you been to Varigotti? Have you been to that town?
I haven't, but my photographer is saying in Ligure Finale, which is 10 minutes away.
Absolutely, just down the road.
And he's going this week to Punta Crena because we're going to be writing about them for the book. When did you start representing Kermit's wines, and how has that transition been?
It's been incredible. A couple things. I really like the Kermit portfolio. That's obvious. I think most people are aligned in some way with that portfolio. It's historic. I've always liked Punta Crena in particular. In fact, my wife and I booked a trip to Varigotti before any of this Kermit stuff happened. So we were going to go, because I've always been enamored with the wines and They're very interesting. Yeah, it's been a great transition. You need attention here in this market, to be brutally honest. There's something about the cycle of just kind of you soften on attention, you bring something. This partnership just came out of nowhere, and I think it's going to be great for both sides. They've never worked with anyone like T. Edward. That's for certain. We're definitely the jazz band of New York, and we've never worked with Kermit. We're not really an importer-driven portfolio. We're very much direct-driven. So this was a big departure, and I'm really happy with the way it's going. We're still in kind of the early honeymoon phase. Things are still just getting out. Things were out of stock. All the normal, boring logistical things. But there's a lot there. Guido Porro also. That's a very interesting estate. Very interesting. Rionda, the old Jocosa plot that got split up, and now Porro has Rionda, which is amazing. Like nearly a half hectare.
Yeah, the red label Rionda is some of the most sought after expensive wines.
Yeah.
That's wild. And so you were in, how long were you in Liguria for?
4 days.
Did you visit other producers? Did you go to Enfosa, is another Kermit producer? I don't know if you're...
No, you guys, we don't work with them. We were there to just sit on the beach.
Yeah.
And eat some seafood. And we had one visit.
Eat some frito misto I saw on the
there
Instagram.
Was a, yeah. There was, it felt like work this time in Piemonte, because there were lots of curveballs and schedule changes, which is kind of like my day-to-day as a salesperson. There's always a bunch of stuff changing. So we needed a little break. It was amazing. I highly recommend. There is nothing in Varigotti, but a couple great restaurants, a lovely beach, walk down. It's inexpensive. And Punta Crena.
And Punta Crena.
And you walk right up into the terraces. It's a really fun hike. The olive trees everywhere. It's amazing.
I'm going to take you up on that. Unfortunately, I have to try to hit up all 20 regions for this wine.
So what are you excited about? What's the region that you haven't been to that you're really, or maybe you've been everywhere, but I'm curious.
Well, I haven't explored the vineyards of Lazio as much as, or at all. No, I've been to a couple, but I think that I haven't been to the most exciting producers, and I'm convinced that Lazio is the place to watch in Italy. Lazio is where cool things are happening.
Wow. That is a strong statement.
Well, because it's like it's Bushwick. It's, you know, artists can move there. Young people can move there. You can expect, like, land is so cheap. You can.
It'd be amazing to be next to a Roman aristocrat. You know, you're like Bushwick.
Yeah,
it's like Bushwick around here.
But I was talking with Joy Cole from La Valana, and she is she went to this nursery. She's on this guy who has 100 indigenous grapes to Lazio, which I didn't even know there were 100. And she's like co-planting a dozen grapes that I've never heard of, and just seeing what happens and doing a little micro vinification. Like, you can't do that in Barolo. You can't do that in Montalcino.
Imported? Those wines?
She's with Dresner.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Cool. I've never had them. I'd love to try them.
They're fine. I mean, her vineyard's so young. I think, they're already so great. Well, Ryan, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
Wow, that was a lot. It flew by.
It flew by, yeah.
Thanks so much for having me on, Joe.
Thank you. I'll have you on. We'll be back on soon, I'm sure.
Awesome.
That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening to In the Drink. Again, I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. You can follow me on Instagram at Joe Campanelli for updates on the show, photos of what I'm drinking, and the occasional Pitbull pick. You can also email me at info@inthedrinkpod.com. And please remember to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. In the Drink is produced by our very talented producer, Jasmine Molly. Special thanks goes to Renny Lopez for the awesome theme music. And last, but by no means least, thank you so much for listening.